Good evening. Thank you for coming out in the rain. I have three special reasons why I accepted Rabbi Schmelz's invitation. The first is over 50-year friendship with the Schmelzer family, going back to Reb Chaim, the rabbi's father, the Chassad Kol Bruch, and Tells. The second reason is to acknowledge the community for our children, Ellie and Shani, and family. This community, and especially the Kol, has provided a wonderful home and a place to be mechanech children. And the third is to acknowledge the importance of the Kol to the community. Having been involved for years with setting up seed programs and mini kolim and kolim, I can tell you that when a kol comes into the community, it's a zman simcha. It's as if all of a sudden a beis hamikdash, lahavdil, would be built in the community. Spirituality all of a sudden takes on a new meaning. And your zeicher to have in this community a wonderful kol. And I want to acknowledge that. I want you to appreciate it. Last week's parsha, the Torah tells us that the chotzer of the Mishkan and later the Beis Hamikdash was 100 amos long and 50 amos wide. Approximately 200 feet long and 100 feet wide. And the Gemara Mesachim tells us that King Agrippus once wanted to know how many Jews there were. So they said, we have an easy way for you to tell. Why don't you count how many Korban Pesach comes? And you'll get an idea. So they gave him a count of twice 600,000 Korban Pesach. I don't know if it's Korban Sochem, it's Korbanus Pesach. However, Korbanus Pesach probably. So you had over 1 million people bringing a Korban Pesach, besides the fact that each person represented a group. All of these people fit into the chotzer. So we have 1 million plus people in a space 200 feet long and 100 feet wide. Obviously a miracle. And we know that it was a miracle that HaKadosh Baruch Hu made that this great amount of people can be in this small area. So the Chofetz Chaim Zecher Tzadik Livracha asks a very simple question. What was the purpose of this ness? Why did you have to have a ness of a small area in which you had so many people? What's the lesson? And the Chofetz Chaim tells us there's a tremendous lesson that boundaries and limitations are words in the physical world. They don't apply to the spiritual world. And since the Beis Hamikdash was a place of spirituality, of Kedusha, so therefore every year the Bnei Yisrael had to be taught a lesson that when we talk about a boundary, Chofetz Chaim says this in one line, I would like to just explain it in my words. When we talk about a boundary, how big this room is, or how much a person can do, or how much time or space, these are all words that apply to the physical world. The minute we start talking about spirituality, about ruchnius, about kedusha, these words don't apply. This lesson was so important, the Chofetz Chaim says, that this ness was done year after year. I've been asked to speak about positive parenting, and I'd like to speak about three simple concepts. The first concept is that each child is different. And to most of us, that seems like a very simple idea, but it's many times hard for a parent to understand that. And the best story I have for that is I was teaching first grade and a very good friend of mine sent his oldest son to my first grade and the boy was a charm. Went through class top of the class, a wonderful boy. And he sent his second son a year later, and also a great kid. And a third son. And then he sent his fourth son, and the boy was a dud. A dud means that when the whole class is learning how to put vowels together with letters, he's still struggling on the letters. And this went on for week after week, and the father, who was a very close friend of mine, would come to the house and literally cry at my table. He says, what do I do with this boy? What do I do with him? Look at my other three sons and look at him and why and how and when. And finally, I decided that the only way for this man to find some peace is to spend some time with a great tzaddik that we had in our community. We had this chus of having Rabbi Yankiv Kamenetsky, Zechem Tzaddik Lebracha, living around the corner for 17 years. So we went to Rabbi Yankiv, and he starts telling Rabbi Yankiv about his heartache, and Rabbi Yankiv looks at him and he says to him, give the boy some space. Give him space and time, and don't compare him. Don't allow anyone to walk into your house and start comparing your children. If someone comes in and starts saying, what are you learning, what are you learning, right away cut them off, because you know it's going to end up with a comparison. He told me afterwards, he once had a mishuluch walked in and he had to almost throw him out of the house because he insisted on asking each child. He said, be supportive to the child. Be constantly supportive and he'll work out. May I tell you that the child today is a grown man who says shiurim that his talmidim just enjoy thoroughly. He became a great Talmud Chacham. It took him time. He blossomed slowly. And had the parent pressured him, had the parent pushed him, because the other children, whenever I hear those words, the other children, it sends a red flag. Each child is totally different. And we have to know that, although they come from the same parents, they sit at the same Shabbos table, they go to the same school, they're totally different. And if you have two children that are alike or three children alike, wonderful. But when the next one comes along that's not alike, realize it and treat them the way they are supposed to be treated, not as the number four that doesn't fit. There's a Gemara that tells us the story of a Tana. I don't remember, maybe the Rosh Yeshiva, the head of the Kollel might remember, of a Rebbe who was teaching, and all of a sudden this Rav walks in and sees he's not in the classroom, he's out somewhere. She walks over to him and says, how come you're not minding your class? She says, I've been teaching for 13 years and I never walked out of the classroom. And even now when I walked out, I'm thinking about them. It's a Gemara. And where was he? He was in a garden. And I once heard somebody explain, what was he doing in the garden? He was looking at the various vegetables and plants and learning a lesson from them. And there's a powerful lesson. The lesson is that radishes grow in 3 weeks, and carrots in 4 weeks, and corn in 6 weeks, and other fruits in 8 weeks. And there's one plant in Africa that you plant it in the ground, and for 5 years you can't see a single thing. And after the fifth year, all of a sudden it sprouts out and becomes a tremendous tall tree growing at the rate of 10 feet a week, if I remember correctly. It's unbelievable. Because every plant has a different rate of growth. And that's what the Rebbe was reinforcing himself with. He once put together a Shabbaton in Niagara Falls. And we had as one of our guests a man who was the chacham of his community, an older man, respected, and a nice man, just a wonderful person to spend time with. And I spent some time with him on Shabbos. And towards the end of Shabbos, I said, could you give me a thought with which to remember you with? Something, let me have something tangible, a gift. So he said, I'll tell you a sentence. And I've been carrying the sentence around for many, many years. He said, don't let the perfect spoil the good. And I remember I was waiting for Abdullah, and right after Abdullah, I wrote it down and felt, wow, I got a Dva Chochma. You heard a Dva Chochma. Don't let the perfect spoil the good. Many times we'll have a situation in Chinuch and other areas of life where we have a good situation, except it, over there it's better. In another situation, it's perfect. It's somewhere else. And we allow the perfect to spoil the good that we have right now. A person should teach himself not to do that. He'll go through life much happier if he learns to appreciate the good. He should strive for the perfect, but not at the cost of making the good into bad. He should appreciate the good. Don't let the perfect spoil the good. And then I'll tell you the story about my friend Chaim. It was the first day that I was teaching first grade in the Yeshiva Spring Valley, and they just had put down a brand new black asphalt driveway, playground actually, and marked it off with lines. And Rabbi Greenbaum Zatzal had all the boys line up according to grades. So we had the 8th grade boys standing on their line, and Rabbi Mashinsky, Zatzal, whoever was the principal teacher there, was standing in 7th grade, 6th grade, 5th grade, all the way down to 1st grade. And he called the name of the teacher and the boys. They all walked into class. And finally he called 7th, 6th, and 5th, and 4th, and 3rd, and 2nd. And he called 1st grade, Mr. Shulman, please take your boys in. And I turn around and look, and there are 10 boys standing, a space, and then there's another 8, 9 boys. And on the space, there's a boy laying on the ground. We'll call him Chaim. And I look at him and I said, Chaim, what are you doing on the ground? He said, the rabbi said we should be on the line. I'm on the line, am I not? That was my introduction to Chaim. I spent 1 year with Chaim as his classroom Rebbe, and 7 years after that with Chaim as his occasional Rebbe. Because during the next 7 years, more often than not, the door would swing open and a Rebbe, 2nd grade, 4th grade, whoever it is, would walk in with Chaim and say, Mr. Shulman, can Chaim spend some time in back of your class for a day or two, whatever. In the world of machinery, when they install a gigantic x-ray machine or CAT scan, they bring a technician along with it to calibrate it. Calibrate means to adjust every one of the hundreds of dials exactly where it's supposed to be. And then 3 months later, 6 months later, they send the technician back to recalibrate the machine, because it's understood that after usage, these little dials get a little bit out of perfect alignment. So therefore, they have somebody come down and recalibrate the machine. I did that for 7 years with Chaim. The door would fling open, and the Rebbe would say, can he sit here a little while? And what the Rebbe was really saying to me is, can you recalibrate him and make him into a mensch? I remember when he was in 4th grade, his parents came to a PTA meeting and came in, and I looked at them and I said, Chaim's in 4th grade. They said, yeah, let us talk to you for a minute. They closed the door, they sat down and said, can you please tell us again that Chaim is going to make it in life? And I didn't know whether I should laugh or cry. But I want to tell you what Chaim grew up to be. Chaim is the most wonderful person you can imagine. We're going to be here for Purim, but usually he comes to visit us on Purim every year. Chaim is one of the Amudim, one of the proud supporters of his community, does tremendous amount of chesed, wonderful wife and three children, and Chaim is a pride to Klal Yisrael. He marched to a different drummer, and the Rabbeim had to appreciate that. If not, they could have taken his child and ruined him for life. And the parents have to appreciate it. And it goes back to what we said before. Not every child fits exactly the mold, and we have to be careful to make sure to treat each child according to what he needs. Not necessarily easily, but nevertheless doable, and the end product, Baruch Hashem, a wonderful, wonderful, happy, wholesome, healthy, contributing person to Klal Yisrael. Concept number two is in the area of criticism. And we'll call it criticize gently. Criticism is one of the sore spots in parenting. There are parents who honestly believe that they were sent down to this world and given children in order to make sure that the child does everything 100% right, and their job is to stand there and watch him and make sure everything, and criticize him continually. And usually the results are not pleasant. Start over the pasuk. The pasuk in Mishlei says, "Al toichach leitz pen yisno eko." Don't give musa to a leitz. A leitz is a scoffer. A leitz is a not serious person. Pen, perhaps, yisno eko, he will hate you. When you walk over to somebody who's not a serious person and start telling them, giving them musa, it's just not going to work. It's not going to happen. He's going to walk away, and the first thing he'll say in English, which is, mind your own business, what are you bothering me for? I mean, get off my back. I mean, we have a whole group of expressions. Yes, no, I'll end up hating you. However, the Pasuk says, Hoychach l'chochem, give musa to the chochem, to the wise person, v'yahaveko, and he will love you. So normally this Pasuk is understood to mean two different people. Don't waste your time with the leitz, with the person who's not going to take you seriously. Spend your time, if you want to give musa, with the chochem. That's how we normally understand the pasuk. Rav Gifter Zecher Tzadik Livracha once told me, pshat in the pasuk is different. It's the same person who has many different facets to his personality. He has weaknesses which we can call leitz, the not serious part of him. Things that he does wrong, however, we're going to understand that. And then he has strengths, places that he shines, places that he's good, and times that he's good. So the Pasuk is telling us that al toichach leitz, don't zoom in, don't focus in on his weakness, because he'll end up hating you. But rather, hoichach l'chochem, give musa to the part of him. Talk to the part of him that's strong. Talk to the part of him where it has wisdom to it, to the chochem part. Be a vekka, and he will love you. I think that's the introduction that we have to give to this concept of criticism. Rav Palm, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, told us at a Torah Masoreth convention, a fascinating story. He said that he was at a wedding, and a man walks over to him and says, "Rebbe, I doubt if you remember me, but I was in your first class that you gave at Turbidas as a Rebbe." He says, "Wonderful." He says, "Rebbe, I have to tell you, I didn't learn much in that class." What's a pompous answer? But, there was one lesson you taught me that I'll never forget. Well, Rapam says, "What was that lesson?" She says, "Well, Rapam was the first Rebbe to institute written tests for Gemara. So every week, I would assume, every second week, he handed out sheets, and everybody was filling out the Gemara test. And the young man says, I always sat in the back, in the last row. And I didn't know the answers to almost any of the questions on the test.
So I borrowed some answers from the boy on the right and a little bit from the boy on the left, and you sort it. And he says, all of a sudden, I see Rebbe walking down the row, headed right for me. And I'm thinking to myself, uh-oh, here it comes. And he's got halfway down, and he looked me straight in the eye, and he says, Chaim, if you had difficulties with the question, why don't you ask me? I'll be happy to help you. The young man says, Rebbe, I didn't have any difficulty with the question. You knew that, and I knew that, and every boy in the class knew that. I had difficulties to the end. And you could have so easily, justifiably, say, what are you looking at? What are you cheating for? What are you taking? You did. You saved face. And to that he said, I remember that for decades, and I use that. My whole relationship with people is to make sure that I always save face, in spite of the fact that I'm right, in spite of the fact that I caught them, in spite of the fact that I could really say something strong to them. That's the power of saving face. There is a man whose name you'd all recognize, who is today in his 70s, a mechanech, world-renowned mechanech. And someone once asked him, who is your best Rebbe? And without blinking an eye, he said, fifth grade Rebbe. Fifth grade Rebbe? What happened in fifth grade? Who is this great Rebbe? He said the Rebbe's name. He said, why do you remember him as being your best Rebbe? So he said, well, I'll tell you a story. This Rebbe would write down on the board the names of the boys who deserved some type of a punishment. They spoke in the middle of class. Maybe he would look over the names before recess and take away a few minutes to recess, or maybe not, minor infractions, just didn't want to be disturbed in the middle of learning. So he wrote down their names on the board. And one day, the principal walks in. And the principal walks in, sits down in the back of the room, and the Rebbe all of a sudden moves, backs up to the board, and they continue learning for a few minutes, and then the principal says, okay, goodbye, and walks towards the door. And the Rebbe walks towards the door to walk him out, and all the boys see that the Rebbe's jacket was all full of chalk. What he did was, he moved back and forth, rubbed up against the chalkboard, in order to erase the names of the boys. Because he didn't want these boys to be embarrassed that their names were on the board where the principal should see it. They deserved whatever they deserve, but not for the principal to see it. He saved face. So 50 years later, this man who's a world-renowned mechanech looks back at his chinuch. He went to first grade and second grade and sixth grade and eighth grade, and then he went to high school, and he had 15 rabbeim, and you say to him, who was the Rebbe that left the greatest impact on you? And it comes up with the Bein Odom L'Chaveroi, a Rebbe who did something to save face, a Rebbe who made sure not to embarrass the names of three boys sitting in the class. An unbelievable insight into the impact of what saving face does to a person. I spoke to a group of parents, and afterwards, a woman comes over to me, woman, 40s or 50s, and says to me, I want to tell you a story. I have a bunch of siblings, and we were a rough and tough group, really. I mean, we ran the house. My mother and father put up with us. A tough, tough group. And one day, I was the one who did something wrong. She didn't tell me what it was, but the mother said to her, you wait until Tati comes home, and Tati. And all of a sudden, Tati walks into the house, and the mother says to the father, let's go into the kitchen, and they close the door into the puddle.
And we know exactly what's going on in there. And the father opens up the door and he says, Leah, come with me. Father takes her. And they go into the library. He had a long library. He walks in and she's scared stiff. And the first thing he does is he locks the door. And she figures, that's it. I'll never get out of here alive. I mean, clearly. And then he says to her, without even speaking, and they go to the opposite end of the room, and he sits down next to her. He was fully aware that every one of her brothers and sisters had their ears glued to the door on the outside. And he starts whispering to her in tatnus tatnus, which means he gave it to her with all his might. He told her, but in such a whisper that nobody else was able to hear outside this room. She says, years went by, and so many other things happened, and that always remained as a landmark to me, a milestone. This is the way you give Musa. You give Musa in a way that doesn't shame the person more than you have to. He had to tell me what he had to, and he told it to me, but it didn't have to be done in front of my siblings. So, therefore, privacy becomes one of the major ways in criticizing a child. If we were to ask a group of people, and I've done this many times, that if you worked in an office and you really did something wrong, and the boss is going to call, going to come to you and tell you what you did wrong, what was the one thing you would want? They all answer right away, privacy. I'm doing it in a private office. I don't want to do it in front of my colleagues. I don't want to do it in front of everybody else. And that's one of the first things you have to think about when we're ready to criticize. And many times, parents will have 2, 3, 4 children and will come back with report cards, and the parents will look at the report card and say, Reuven, you did beautifully, 4 olives and 2 A's, and Shimon, you did nicely, and Levi, what happened? Why? And I wonder, why is his report card have to be shown to the others? Why do the others have? Because we even are insulted, we're even hurt in front of siblings. That's what I want to share with you. Embarrassment doesn't necessarily mean in front of strangers, in front of colleagues. It means even siblings. We have to be super sensitive that when we talk to a child, it has to be done in a way that nobody else is involved except that particular child. One of the things that parents tell me, and I've experienced it myself, is that we get angry, and then the anger is projected onto the criticism. The Rambam writes that anger, which is a tremendously powerful tool, he writes, a person should have kas haponim v'loy kas halev, anger of the face and not anger of the heart, which means you can look angry and you can speak angrily and to convey the message, but you can't be angry inside. Now, I've had trouble with this Rambam for many, many years, because when I looked angry and I sounded angry, you know what? I became angry. So I found a Pirush somewhere that said, if you can't control that, never use anger. Very interesting. I've had an experience with anger that left a remarkable memory in my mind. And every time I go to this particular community, I remind myself of it, because now the little boy who drove me to that level of anger and pulled my chain is now president of a yeshiva and one of the most kovadik yidden in that community. But when he was in my first grade, he wasn't. And one day, I remember clear as day, once and twice, and then finally, you know, he said something or did something and just blew me. So I looked at him and I said, Reuven, and his name isn't Reuven,
I said, Ruvane, I'm going to take away your recess. And I thought to myself, not enough. For the rest of your life. Okay, you got that. I imagine you heard it. Well, the first thing that comes today to my mind is Ruvane, who might someday be 89 years old in a nursing home, and they're learning a little bit Daf Yomi, and the rabbi says, okay, we've learned for 45 minutes, let's stop and we'll have some coffee and cake and we'll continue. And Ruvane says, I can't. Rabbi said, I can never have recess for the rest of my life. But the point is, I wonder often what the other children thought. What did the rest of the school think? Because I said it in a way that they heard. What went through Ruvane's mind? A few days later, I apologized to him. But the point is, what happened? And the answer is very simple. When you become angry, you lose sight of everything. Everything changes. And especially when we're criticizing children, we'll say things for which we'll be sorry. And we'll do things for which we'll be sorry. And the truth of the matter is that if you can't control it, then you have to allow yourself a cooling down period and criticize the child, especially if punishment is involved, when you're calm-headed, when you can think clearly. But if you try to criticize a person or truly punish a person, give them punishment when you're angry, it almost always, I never remember, someone told me they can never remember, this was a quote, when they did something in anger that they shouldn't have to apologize a day later. This was a quote to a friend of mine. The Pasuk in Mishlei says that a person should learn how to allow for anger, not to do it right away, but to give it time. And then the Pasuk switches gears and says, v'sifartoid, but if you want to live an elegant life, to forgive. That's talking about adults when we're not obligated to criticize. But when we're obligated to criticize, when we have to, that's part of our job as a teacher, as a parent, we have to do it judiciously, we have to do it in a way that will be effective. And there's a whole list of ways to be effective, but anger is surely, truly one of the things high on the list of ineffective ways. And then I'd like to tell you my dentist story. This story has been around for the past number of years. Some of you may have heard it, and if you did, I apologize to you, but it's so good, it deserves to be said over again. My children all went to a dentist, and they came to me and they said, we decided we want to change dentist. Okay. We looked around and we found someone who has a reputation of being a wonderful dentist, a little bit more expensive, but he sent my daughter, who needed a lot of dental work, she went. She said, nice man, wonderful. Came back, the next child went, the next child had, all my children went, and finally I dug up the courage and I decided I'm going to go to the dentist. I call up. We have an appointment for 3 o'clock on Tuesday. Well, 3 o'clock on Tuesday, so by Sunday already you feel a little bit on edge, you're nervous. By Monday, nobody can talk to you civilly. By Tuesday, you're climbing the walls. Okay. Well, when I traveled, I learned how to utilize a lot of my travel time productively. So I had a special briefcase that I only used in 2 occasions. In the briefcase was a safer, a book, a cassette player, pad and paper. When I traveled, I took this with me. It was a special working briefcase. And when I went to doctor's or dentist's office, because my experience has been, you have a 3 o'clock appointment by a doctor or a dentist, you walk in, the first thing the nurse says to you is, emergency is a little bit late, and you sit there for an hour and 10 minutes, and they come back to you, and they say, oh. So therefore, I always take this with me. So I walk with this into the dentist's office at 5 to 3, and the nurse says, okay, dentist is ready for you. Why don't you go in? Okay. As I'm walking in, she says, wait a minute. Would you want to listen to a cassette? And she hands me a cassette player. and she shows me a library of cassettes, different voice cassettes and singing cassettes. And I took a cassette, I happened to take a cassette of a person who I never had the opportunity to hear, and I became fascinated and listened to it every time I'd go to the dentist, to the point where I listened to it today even, and my teeth start tingling. You know, how that's... But anyway, okay, so I'm sitting in the dentist chair now, listening to this cassette, and he works on me, he sends me home, and 3 hours later I get a phone call from his nurse. And the phone call says, how do you feel? I feel? Okay. So I think to myself, good PR. Good. Second time I went to him, exact same thing. To the minute, and then the cassette player, and then I go home, I got a phone call from the nurse. The third time, exact same thing. The fourth time I walked into him and said, wait a minute, before you touch me, you got to explain to me what's happening. He says, I'll work on you first, and we'll talk afterwards. So we did. I said to him, tell me what's happening here. I mean, obviously, you're running a practice here slightly different than I'm used to. She said, well, I'll tell you. When I was in dental school, I discovered that dentists have the worst reputation as likability. Every year they ask, who do you like best? He said, people... The worst one, people who hate, who do you hate the most or who do you like the least, is always a dentist, for a very good reason. A dentist means pain. He said, I worked on this problem for a long time. I could be the best dentist if I didn't have to drill. But I have to drill. If I don't drill, I'm not doing my job right. So I struggled with the following question. How could I drill and hurt the patient least? How could I drill in a way that does the least discomfort? Listen to this, Bain. Adam Lechaber, listen to this. And I came up with the following idea. There are four problems when you drill. First is pain. For that we give Novocaine. The second is heat. And for that we have a water that comes out at the same time the drill, there's a water that comes out. The third is noise, and for that we give you a cassette player. So you drown out the noise. I don't remember what the fourth was. Anyway, he says the reason why we give you a cassette player is to drown out the noise, because the noise travels right up through your cheekbone, and therefore you'll be less pained, you'll think about it less, you'll listen to what you're listening to, and you will be a better patient, you'll be more relaxed. I sat there and I said, wow, tell me about why the nurse calls me. See, can you explain that to me? He says, every time I have a new patient, I want to be able to go to sleep at night and to know that the patient's not in pain. So I have my nurse call my new patient to find out. Wonderful. Then I asked him another question. Is there anything that you do that I don't know about? He says, one more thing. He says, when I put an injection of Novocaine into your gum, there are two things that happen. One is the fact that the needle goes into the gum, and second thing is the fluid of the Novocaine is at a different temperature than the body. The fluid of Novocaine sits on the shelf for the little vial and is room temperature. Your body is at a totally different temperature, 98. And therefore you're uncomfortable. So what I do is I take the Novocaine and I warm the Novocaine for a half a minute and bring it up to body temperature so you won't feel the jolt when you put it into your gum. And I'm sitting in his office and thinking to myself, what I'm listening here to is a schmooze of Yahavarecha Kamoicha. And then I walk out and say, you know, we teachers, we parents, are faced with the same thing. We'd be the most likable people if we didn't have to criticize. If we didn't have to say anything to a child, if we always were able to say yes, if we're always able to please a child, we would be great. Except we wouldn't be doing our job, just like the dentist wouldn't be doing his job. But that doesn't give him the right
to do whatever he wants and not be concerned about the pain to the patient. And in the same way, it doesn't give us the right to criticize in a way that might hurt the child if there's another way out. And that's the lesson that we have. Warm the Novocaine. Make sure that the criticism comes in a way that hurts the child the least. Don't do it when they had a bad day. Don't do it when they have their weakness. Try to criticize the child in a way that helps him the most. The third area. The third area is joy and pride. More so than any other time in history, probably, we have to have homes. We have to have homes that are overwhelmingly besimcha. If we want to hold on to our children, especially if we have a child that begins looking elsewhere and a child who begins questioning in ways that trying to find other directions, we have to have a home in which a child feels is totally besimcha. My Rosh Yeshiva, Rav Motl Katz, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, once told us a beautiful thought. In Yiddish, there's expression, it's hard to be a Jew. It's shver zu sein a Yid. He said, that's wrong. The correct expression should be, it's shver zu sein a halb Yid. It's hard to be a half a Jew. And he gave us an example of what he's talking about. You have a man who has a store, a typical example, and it's Friday afternoon and Lichtenstein is 5 o'clock and it's 4 o'clock and his store's full of people that want to buy and he looks at the clock, it's getting later, and every time the clock moves 10 minutes, another two people walk in and he's looking and finally it's 5 to 5 and he says to himself, oh, I just can't handle it. I can't be Machal Shabbos. And he sends him out that it hurts him. The fact that he lost a few dollars from the potential sales. And he walks home and he's so broken by this. And he comes in and he sits down and he davens. He goes to shul. He doesn't go to shul. And he sits at the Shabbos table, morbid by the loss of his financial. And this is the halbiyid. Yishrei Shabbos. Without any of the benefits of Shabbos. Down the block is another store where the man closes the store, also full of buyers, at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And he sings to himself, what a schus I had of being a shomer Shabbos and able to walk out on these people. And he goes home and he goes to the mikveh and he comes home and he dresses and he goes to shul on Shabbos and comes home and he sits at the Shabbos table and he sings besimcha. This is the Yid who it's not shver zu sein a Yid. This is the man who it's not hard to be a Jew. To him, it's easy to be a Jew. And I think that's an example for all the things that happen in our home. We have to do mitzvahs passionately if we expect our children to be able to see in our home what's really important. I teach a group of Kol men in Lakewood. So one day, we had an extra few minutes, and I asked them the following question. What would be if you came to Mincha, and Mincha was supposed to be 5 o'clock, and you walked in 10 minutes to 5, and you sat down, and you said whatever you say before Mincha, and you look at the clock, and you have an extra 2 or 3 minutes. What would you do with those 2 or 3 minutes? And you want to dedicate those 2 or 3 minutes to improving your mincha. Okay? What would you think about? So, one man says, think about Adai Nolom, Yigdal, 13, Ikrim. Another man says, Sheish Mrs. Timidius. Another man says, that the Chesed, HaKadosh Baruch Hu did for me. And one man said, and he said it with such conviction that I had a suspicion, which I later found out was true, that he didn't come up with this just while we were talking about it. He said, I would thank HaKadosh Baruch Hu for the five great gifts that he gave me. So I said, what are the five great gifts? She said, the first gift is life and health. Wonderful. And the second gift, and in my mind, I'm thinking to myself, second gift is family. The second gift is the fact that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave me an opportunity to do mitzvahs. And he says, do you realize what kind of gift that is? I wake up in the morning and have a mitzvah of tzitzis, have a mitzvah of tefillin, have a mitzvah of tefillah, have a mitzvah of learning, have a mitzvah of tzedakah. I go through the day, every brach I make. What a great gift HaKadosh Baruch Hu has given me. There are billions of people on this earth who go through a day without any meaning. There are billions of people who go through the day without not even understanding what they're here for. And I have the source of serving HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's what I'm here for. And I serve him in big ways and small ways. That's the greatest gift. Then he went on to tell me the second, the third thing was his wife and children, and Panosa, and the fifth thing was the Shem Tov, the fact that he has a nice reputation, people. And it left such an impact on me. His appreciation for the fact that he has mitzvahs. He has the schus, because of Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, recognized HaKadosh Baruch Hu, therefore HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave them the Torah, them and their children. And we today, generations later, have these same mitzvahs, which will, Mitzvah Shem, give us a life here and a life, Mitzvah Shem, afterwards. What a source it is. That's the type of an inspiration. That's the type of a joy and pride that has to fill a home. And when a child sees that type of relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, we have every reason to believe the child will want that type of a life, especially when he looks around the rest of the world and sees how lack of inspirational life that they lead. Okay. We touched on several points. We started off with a vort from the Chofetz Chaim, which is a beautiful vort. Limitations are physical. In Ruchnius, there are no limitations. What a beautiful thought to carry with you. And Ruchnius means when you open up a Gemara. Ruchnius means when you want to do a mitzvah. It's not just in the Beis HaMikdash. Anything that has to do with Ruchnius, anything that has to do with Kedusha, with spirituality, there are no limitations. That's one lesson. Then we spoke about the concept that each child is different. Each child has to be dealt with differently. And the second thing, and not compared, the second thing we spoke about was to criticize gently. Al toichach leitz pen yisnoeko. Find the chochem part of the child and try to talk to that part. We spoke about saving face. We spoke about privately. We spoke about never in anger. We spoke about the dentist story and warm the Novocaine. And the last thing we spoke about is joy and pride. It's hard to be a Jew when all you have are the limitations or the having to close the store for Shabbos. But if you don't enjoy the simchas ha-mitzvah, you don't enjoy the joy of doing the mitzvah, then really you only have half of Yiddishkeit. Do mitzvahs passionately. And then remember this Kol Jungerman's list of five gifts that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave us. Health, life and health, and the Torah. We, many of us as children, grew up thinking the Torah only limits us. It's not a gift, it's a limitation. As you grow older, you realize what HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave us is the gift, and that has to be given over to children. It's a push to be able to speak to you. You have a meaningful Purim, and Mitzvah Shem have the schus of having your children grow up to be great B'nai Torah and wonderful Nachas. Thank you.